Voices and Events. The National Broadcasting Company brings you Voices and Events, the living dramatic record of history this week, recorded by the NBC News and Special Events Department. You'll hear Cyrus Ching, President Truman, Pope Pius and the Sistine Choir, Ernest Bevin, Admiral Blandy, and the voice of Wendell Willkie. These and many others, the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Now, here's your editor for Voices and Events, James Fleming.
The deadline was midnight Friday, but even before it came, the hot furnaces that make the nation steel were being cooled, and the strike was on. Steel in the making, the actual sound recorded in a giant plant of the United States Steel Corporation. Now that sound is stilled. The pickets are on the march. 500,000 men on strike at 300 plants in 27 states. Why? Hear it from both sides in this first big steel walkout since 1946. Hear it first from Republic Steel spokesman E.J. McGee.
Republic today made this offer to the union, and the union flatly rejected it. We offered a new and large program providing for life, sickness and accident, and hospitalization insurance, and surgical benefits. Republic would contribute 4 cents per hour worked for each participating employee toward the cost of this plan, and the employees would contribute a sum which in the aggregate would not be less than 2 cents per hour worked as compared to 3.5 cents which the employees are now paying under our present insurance plan.
But to this, the CIO Steelworkers' William Donovan replies,
the United Steelworkers of America's CIO stands ready to negotiate and settle our dispute with the Republic Steel Corporation on the basis of the Presidential Fact-Finding Committee's report and recommendations. The union will not retreat from its present demands.
All that was said in the dwindling hours before the strike call went out. Now there's quiet. The government mediators are watching, hopefully. Management and union are digging in for the economic battle. Listen now to the man who tried so hard to stop it and will probably try again before so very long. He's the chief government mediator, Cyrus Ching.
Mediators cannot work miracles. They can only help disputants who are disposed to help themselves in resolving their differences. The interest and welfare of the public is at stake, as well as that of the parties. The current disputes will be settled sometime, with or without a stoppage. No one ever won a war. No one ever won a strike or lockout.
Last night in Los Angeles, a private plane crashed in a residential district, bringing death to one of America's most popular entertainers.
Buddy Clark had a way with a song. But for a long time, he was a voice behind the screen, filling in for movie stars who couldn't sing. After the war, Buddy Clark really came into his own, leaped to top favor with the fans who determine our nation's idols. Last night, with a party of friends, he was flying home from a football game in Palo Alto. The plane's motors failed, and the pilot crash-landed on a busy boulevard in Los Angeles. A few hours later, Buddy Clark died from his injuries. The end of a career for the man Al Jolson had called the best of the popular singers.
It's a big, wide, wonderful world you live in. When you're in love, you're a master. Of all you survey, you're a gay Santa Claus. You've a kingdom, power and glory, the all.
Radio will miss this gay troubadour. His good humor, his laughter, and above all, his songs.
Women in the news. And back to our shores this week came an old favorite of grand opera and the music world. Her name, Mary Garden.
Newsmen who boarded the liner steaming into New York Harbor remembered Mary Garden as a slim, vivacious lady with rusty blonde hair who dominated the operatic stage in the 1920s. She'd changed little now, still slim, still perky at age 72.
I've come to America to see the, hear the Metropolitan and your new singers and see if there's anybody that I admire.
How about Margaret Truman, they asked. Would you like to hear her sing?
Oh, I'd love to hear her. I'd love to hear her. I wonder if she'd sing for me.
Well, that's one item on Mary Garden's agenda. At her hotel, away from the bustle of the ship, the opera star tells more about herself and her return to the USA.
18 years ago, I sang my last performance of grand opera in your great country. I am now over for a short visit to see you all again. And with what joy I am looking forward to it. I have been living far from you in my beautiful country of Scotland, where I only hear music through the radio. So goodbye until we meet.
Another lady was very much in the news this week because she isn't saying anything at all.
Now, this would be Mrs. Carlton Hadley, the lovely St. Louis lady who's the object of Vice President Barclay's attention. The Veep kept newsmen hopping all week long. All sorts of rumors about his plans. A Chicago jeweler said that he'd sold the Veep what looked very much like an engagement ring. But Mr. Barclay and Mrs. Hadley weren't talking. One guess that might be better than others could come from the Veep's boss. And this week in Kansas City, Harry Truman had this to say.
We're glad, we're very glad, that we've managed to get our distinguished vice president to visit a place in Missouri outside of St. Louis. The vice president is a grand man, and I'm proud that he's my friend and my counselor, and I'm also exceedingly glad that he's about to become a citizen of Missouri.
President Truman also did battle this week with those of his critics who accuse him of leading us into a welfare state. In socialist Britain, labor government critics were sounding the same theme.
In the wake of the pound's devaluation, the laborite government of England survived a parliamentary test this week, and with it came a growing realization that elections must be held and soon. There are many angles to the laborite program, and NBC's Morgan Beatty, who was in London this week, turned up this sidelight on life in Britain.
Britons are torn these days between a downright hatred for excessive controls on the one hand and a feeling on the other that after all, things are better for the working people than ever before. British subjects laugh up their sleeves at things like today's order by the Ministry of Food, an order to the jelly makers. It's issued under the title Food Standards, Table Jellies, Order 1949. It says, after the jelly is cooked, a sample of the solution shall be immediately introduced into each of 6 beakers of approximately 5 centimeters diameter and the beakers cooled for 18 hours in a water bath maintained at 16 degrees centigrade. At the end of this period, each beaker shall be immersed in a water bath at approximately 50 degrees centigrade for 8 seconds. Upon removal, each beaker shall be immediately dried and contents transferred to a plate or dish by inversion of the beaker. That, in the eyes of many Britons, is like telling grandmother how to cook when you don't know how yourself.
Vacations are over for most Americans now, but one family was just starting out this week, if you could call it a vacation.
In Troy, New York, the family of Mr. and Mrs. Harry Bailey all started out on their first vacation in 20 years. You see, the Baileys have 14 children, and they're all going along in an old school bus bought specially for the trip to the West. As Mrs. Bailey said,
every one of the children has his own job to do. Each of the older ones will take care of one of the younger ones. Of course, they're going to do some studying while they're away.
Now, listen as they call the roll of the Bailey family before boarding the bus.
Beverly, 18.
Buddy, 17.
Barry, 16.
Barbara, 14.
Betty, 13.
Bradley, 12.
Ryan, 10.
Bernice, 9.
Blake, 8.
Brenda, 6.
Brenda, 4.
Bill, 3.
Too young to speak for themselves, Bernard, he's 2, and Benjamin, 1. Quite a busload, the 16 Baileys, and, oh yes, Grandpa and Grandma are joining the party, too. Makes 18 in all.
At a time when the world hears much of tension and strife, millions of people are planning a pilgrimage of peace. Voices and Events brings a preview of 1950, the Holy Year.
Those are the bells of St. Peter's as we recorded them a few days ago in Rome, a city preparing to receive 2.5 million Roman Catholic pilgrims during 1950. For this will be the Holy Year, a time set apart every quarter century for the faithful to come to the Eternal City. Listen now to the voice of His Holiness Pope Pius XII as he spoke in Italian and proclaimed the 12 months beginning next Christmas Eve as another Holy Year.
E a tutto l'universo cattolico l'annunzio che nel 1950 Il venticinquesimo anno santo nella storia della Chiesa sarà celebrato, se così piacerà al Signore, secondo le forme consacrate dalla veneranda tradizione.
In Vatican City, great preparations are underway to receive the pilgrims who will come to worship from nearly every country on earth, yes, even from those nations behind the Iron Curtain. With NBC's Jack Bagan, I took our Voices and Events microphone into the square of St. Peter's, where the normal tranquility is broken by sounds of builders at work. Listen as Jack Bagan describes the scene.
Standing here in the center of the beautiful square of St. Peter's, looking down the Avenue of the Conciliation toward the Tiber, the feverish bustle of Holy Year preparation is more obvious than in any other section of the Eternal City. The first two buildings going up on either side of a broad avenue leading into the outstretched arms of the porticos of the Basilica of St. Peter will house religious exhibits from all over the world. On down the avenue are various buildings, some finished, some being repaired, others not much more than foundation. At the far end of the avenue, two towering buildings are nearly finished. They will be of the greatest importance to the needy pilgrims who will make the journey only with the greatest of sacrifice. With financial aid donated by the Vatican and other religious orders, these buildings will house thousands of poor pilgrims in simple but clean and comfortable dormitories. You see, this Holy Year pilgrimage is not only for the tourist who can travel in comfortable first-class accommodations. Even the little peasant from Calabria, who may arrive in a battered old donkey cart, will be welcomed and cared for in this eternally beautiful city.
Pilgrims from nearby arriving by donkey cart, others from America coming to Rome by air. For this is the first holy year in the history of the Catholic Church when the faithful will be flying the Atlantic in order to make their pilgrimages. Transworld Airlines, for example, will have several daily Constellation flights to Rome during the holy year and has arranged special rates for groups of pilgrims. Now, through the courtesy of the Vatican Radio, we catch a glimpse of some of the ceremonial pageantry that will mark these next 12 months in Rome. Here, broadcast for the first time in America, is the entrance into St. Peter's of His Holiness Pope Pius. First the silver trumpets of the guards, then a ripple of applause, growing into cheers as the pontiff makes his appearance, and finally, the magnificent Sistine Chapel Choir with the anthem, You Are Peter. Let it be said that in the time of the atom, the ancient tradition survived to bring peace to the troubled pilgrims who take the road to Rome during 1950.
You are listening to Voices and Events, the living record of history compiled by NBC's News and Special Events Department, the actual voices of the people who made the news this week as they made it. Now, from the NBC Newsroom in New York, here again is James Fleming.
In this second week since President Truman's announcement that the Russians had mastered atomic secrets, we began to speak of their accomplishment as the other bomb. Some of the shock had passed. Bold opinions were heard, but the people of this atomic age still look to the United Nations now that there's both an East and West version of the bomb. How are we doing there at the UN in this second week? Perhaps the answer came from British Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin when he said,
"Now may I turn to the vexed question of atomic energy. We continually hear the plea of prohibition of the atomic weapon and an attempt to place blame upon us and others for failing to make prohibition a reality. This is really a stupid charge. We're as anxious as anyone for prohibition. Are we now to understand that the Soviet government will now accept the decision of the United Nations? It is not obstruction on our part or on the part who think as we do that have prevented agreement. It means, therefore, that they must come out of their shell, raise their curtain, open the way to the system of control approved by the General Assembly, which we and others, the majority, believe in our hearts as the only thing that will give us adequate security.
If there's to be a shooting war, a likely spot for the beginning of the trouble would be Yugoslavia.
Вопрос ставится так. Или мы будем здесь состязаться...
That's the voice of Dr. Edward Kardelia, foreign minister of Tito's Yugoslavia, speaking in the General Assembly of the United Nations. This week, Yugoslavia steered its promised course of independence in the World Parliament, voting now with the Soviet bloc, now with the West. So far, the violent rupture of relations between Belgrade and Moscow hasn't been heard in the UN. You hear it, though, from listening posts in Europe, from Joseph Israel, correspondent in Vienna.
At this prime listening post within stone-throwing distance of the Iron Curtain, Western intelligence agencies learned today of heavy Russian arms shipments up the Danube. These intensify the military threat to Tito. Barges and small ocean-going freighters heavily loaded with the largest Molotov tanks, artillery, trucks, and even Soviet troops have been churning upstream from Black Sea ports right through Marshal Tito's own stretch of the river to unloading points in Hungary and Czechoslovakia. They're used to strengthen Red Army divisions gathered on Tito's frontiers and the satellite forces under common form control. Tito can't do anything about all this because he joined enthusiastically in the 1948 Danube Conference held right in his own Belgrade, where a treaty was signed, turning the Danube red from end to end. But now that the treaty denouncing stage has been reached in Moscow, the Danube agreement could be the next to go, if and when Tito is ready to make a shooting issue of who controls the river in his own front yard.
Bluff and bluster from the common form? Maybe. Trouble is, how do you know when it's real, when the showdown and the shooting are in the offing? As intelligence reports were filtered and sifted in Washington, the nation's leaders were taking stock. Congressional leaders like Representative Price of Illinois.
I have just completed a trip through the major atomic installations in our country, and there's every evidence that there has been a stepping up in production. We are greatly advanced. We're far in the lead, and the secret is to stay in the lead. There isn't any security in past achievement in this atomic energy field. The only security we can have is by staying far ahead.
Others gave clues to the military thinking in this second week of the other bomb. For instance, the statement of General Jacob Devers on retiring as commander of the Army Ground Forces.
In the first place, I don't think we're going to have another war. But if there should be one, the infantry will still be the queen of battles. They'll need help, they'll need a team, and that'll take the Navy and the Air Force. The atom bomb is going to be a deterrent for another war. We have to use it, we're going to use it, and we'll probably use it tactically as well as strategically, and I think that'll stop the war in a hurry.
Next, the Navy view. Listen to the commander of Navy forces at Operation Crossroads Bikini, Admiral W.H.P. Blandy.
I'm frequently asked what I think would be the effect of the atomic bomb on naval warfare. Well, from the offensive standpoint, of course, the strategic use of the atomic bomb is the primary responsibility of the Air Force, though the Navy at times might be called on to help. Now, from the defensive standpoint, our greatest concern would be to avoid heavy concentrations of ships in port or in outlying bases. But regarding ships at sea, especially a carrier task force, the normal dispersion of the ships in their tactical formations is already so great that atomic bomb would be most unlikely to get more than one ship.
And speaking of strategy, a man with some very outspoken opinions on the subject was put on the spot last night. He's Navy Captain John Cromlin, and you'll remember the fuss he stirred up when he risked his job to say that the controversy over the Air Force B-36 bomber was weakening the Navy. Well, last night, on the NBC television program Meet the Press, Cromlin was questioned by newsmen, but hours before, he'd been warned by his superiors, stay off that touchy matter. Here's how it went then, when reporter Lawrence Spivak asked,
Captain, when you first spoke out against concentration of power in the Department of Defense, you knew, and I believe you said you knew, that you risked court-martial. And yet you spoke out. Now, what has made you now to obey the order of the Secretary of the Navy?
Well, Mr. Spivak, that's difficult for anyone who hadn't been in the service a long time to understand. The first time that I spoke out, it was more or less what we call disregard of orders. I now have before me a written directive addressed to me personally, and which is a direct order. And I have no intention of disobeying those direct orders.
Well, don't you consider then that an order, an interference, this is an interference with your right of free speech as a citizen of the United States?
I think, sir, that is something that the Secretary of the Navy is better qualified to answer in this respect than I. Evidently, he has information which is not available to me.
It wasn't so long ago we were talking about military strategy of more immediate purpose. The year was 1943, when World War II was a few years old, and the turning point was at hand. Then, too, men talked of peace, and one of them was Wendell Willkie. Remember, he just made a global tour of a world in conflict, and he reported to his nation by radio like this.
Wherever I go, men and women, ordinary men and women, ask me questions eagerly, endlessly. What does Stalin plan? What did Winston Churchill tell you? And I always feel like replying, what do you and millions like you think? For in the final analysis, it is you whose ideas count. It is you who will shape our world if now men come to know that this is one world, that all the parts of it, for their own well-being, are interdependent upon the other parts.
5 years ago this week, Wendell Willkie died. What's become of his idea of one world? Listen now to one who hasn't despaired of that challenging concept. Former Supreme Court Justice Owen J. Roberts.
On this anniversary of the great idea of one world, the Atlantic Union Committee, of which I am president, a national organization, feels that one world cannot be accomplished overnight, but that much can be done now to bring the nations together into a unified federation. We advocate a federation first of those people who practice individual freedom and representative government. Thus, we hope to make a start whereby that great ideal of one world with one government, which Mr. Willkie envisaged, may be accomplished.
Events this week would indicate that some men and some nations are on the warpath, but not in Oklahoma.
Yes. In this day of loyalty checks, Oklahoma saw the perhaps unusual circumstance of a full-blooded Indian taking an anti-subversive pledge. It happened in Pawhuska. A new chief of the Osage tribe was sworn in by the government's Indian agent. Microphones of station KVOO Tulsa were there to record the ceremony. Tom-tom sounded as the tribal council met in the office of the Indian agent. The new chief looked stern with his braided hair and red blanket, taking the oath as head of the Osages and swearing that he's not un-American.
I, John Oberle.
I'm John Oberle.
Do solemnly.
Do solemnly.
Swear.
Swear.
During such time.
During such time.
As I am principal chief.
As I am principal chief.
Of the Osage tribe of Indians.
I am the Osage tribe of Indians.
I will not. Advocate.
Advocate.
Nor become.
A member.
Of any political party.
Of any political parties.
Or organization.
In an organization.
That advocates.
And I advocate.
The overthrow.
An overthrow.
Of the government.
Of the government.
Of the United States.
Of United States.
By force. Or violence.
And violence. That I take this obligation freely, without any reservation.
Many voices were heard on many subjects this week, but loudest and clearest of all were those who spoke about baseball.
My name is Paul Frank. I'm from Brooklyn, New York. I've been following the Dodgers for years. And can't take many more seasons like this one. I mean, how much will my heart stand?
My name is Harold O'Connor, and I'm in a state of collapse from lack of sleep, rooting them Yankees home.
Yes, you heard those sentiments expressed everywhere you went in our town this week, to say nothing of Boston, Philadelphia, and St. Louis. And then there was the man who said...
My name is Eddie Jacoby. I'm from Long Island. And as far as I'm concerned, I don't care who wins.
Brother, he was in a mighty small minority. Yes, baseball took the play from many major stories. Adding to one of the tightest pennant races ever was a series of peculiar rhubarbs that brought furious shouts from already husky throats. It must have been a strange spectacle for those who don't know us. To see ourselves, as others see us about baseball, Voices and Events monitored a broadcast beamed from New York to England by BBC commentator Alastair Cook. As we listened, he was talking about the events of the afternoon of September 26th, when the Red Sox Johnny Pesky came sliding in from third, and the umpire called him safe. And our English friend voiced the feelings of all New Yorkers in saying...
How could the wretched Bostonian be safe when he was dashing for the run that would beat the Yankees? Every Yankee fan burst a blood vessel. The Yankee catcher swore great oaths and lunged for the umpire. The other umpires came running to prevent mayhem. And the rest of the Yankee team galloped over to add whatever colorful resources of language the good Lord has given them for just such occasions, while the stands moaned in bellowing chants. I should explain that this general assault on the offending umpire has nothing whatever to do with what might be called poor sportsmanship. It is an honorable baseball custom. It is essential for a European to appreciate this at a baseball game in order to avoid needless moral wrangles with his neighbor, to say nothing of a broken head. But it is such crises that somehow lift up the people of a whole city and absorb them, even when their survival is threatened by the historic news of the Russian bomb. Such is the healing effect of baseball on a city of 8 million in the week it heard about the Russian bomb.
Yes, that's how Britain heard it. But right now, Voices and Events brings the pennant situation to this minute. The big news from the American League. In a thrilling game here in New York, the Yankees beat the Red Sox 5-3. The New York Yankees, the winners of the American League pennant. The Yankees, that injury-ridden team that led the league from opening day to the stretch run when they were overtaken by the Red Sox. And this payoff game had all the drama the situation called for. The Yankees were off to a one-run lead in the very first inning, and from there to the eighth, a 1-0 pitching duel between the Yankees' Vic Rushy and Red Sox Ellis Kinder. In the eighth, the Yankees scored 4 runs, but in the top of the ninth, there was another Red Sox threat. 3 Red Sox runs came in before the Yankees could get them out of there and take the American League championship. A tough game to lose for the Red Sox. Yankees, 5 runs, 9 hits and no errors. Red Sox, 3 runs, 5 hits and 1 error. And that game between the Dodgers and the Phillies is a wild, rough-and-tumble affair. It's going all the way into extra innings. The Dodgers led all the way up to the sixth when the Phillies caught them. 5 Brooklyn runs in the third inning looked like a big margin with Don Newcomb pitching. But the Phillies came up with 4 in the fourth inning, and Newcomb was out. In the fifth, the Dodgers pulled out to a 7-4 lead, but they couldn't hold that either. 1 run by the Phillies in the fifth, 2 in the sixth, and the score was tied. And now, in the top of the 10th inning in a game not yet completed, the Brooklyn Dodgers have pulled out in front of the Phillies by a score of 9-7. And that's important because the Cardinals have given the Chicago Cubs a lacing. Wow.
This has been Voices and Events, the living dramatic record of history this week, compiled by the NBC News and Special Events Department. You've heard the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Your editor has been James Fleming. This is Robert Warren speaking and inviting you to listen next week at this same time for Voices and Events.
Monday's the night for music on NBC, and joining NBC's great musical lineup tomorrow night is the Railroad Hour, bringing you your favorite show tunes and operettas. On tomorrow's premiere, you'll hear the complete score from Showboat with Gordon McRae and Dorothy Kirsten in the leading roles. Remember, Monday is the night for music, starting with the Railroad Hour on NBC. You're tuned for the stars on NBC.